surf smelt spawning. Occupancy, this is a briefing. So good to see you guys again. Pan fried in a little bacon grease, rolled in flour. Yeah.
This a little closer.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith, members of the commission, deputy director, director. Sorry, a little nervous. I am here today with Dr. Tim Quinn and Dr. Phil Dione to talk to you about a recommendation that our HPA advisory group has made to increase the or to change the occupancy standard for our surf smelt spawning beaches. And we're going to Phil is going to speak today about why what are forage fish and why they're important and how we document their habitat. Tim is going to talk about the study that has spurred the recommendation for the change to the documented the definition of occupied surf smelt spawning habitat. And then I'm going to talk to you about the work that we did with the HPA advisory group and the other outreach we've done in preparation for making this change and kind of the next step we have.
Thanks, Randy. So I know you guys have all heard about forage fish in the past. I've attended some of those meetings, so you all are pretty well informed. But just as a review, I just want to point out the importance of forage fish in case you've forgotten. So forage fish are this conduit of energy from lower-level producers and consumers to higher-level consumers like salmon, marine mammals, seabirds, rockfish, humans, all those things. So I always have to point out that if you like any of those species, you should really like forage fish because they rely on them at some level. But today I want to really focus on one species in particular, which is the surf smelt, which I've got on display here. And this species is of particular concern because of where it chooses to deposit its eggs. So surf smelt are obligate intertidal beach spawners, and this is actually an image of their eggs. And Director Unsworth, if you wouldn't mind passing them around, I brought a little visual aid. These are actually some preserved surf smelt eggs that we collected from the beach to show you what we're actually out there looking for and sort of what we're up against when we're trying to document these beaches. But because of where these fish decide to lay their eggs, there's the potential for conflict with human development, and that's why we're interested in this habitat. So some of the challenges facing surf smelt habitat are what we call direct habitat loss. So this structure here that's labeled with former surf smelt habitat is exactly that. That would have been surf smelt spawning habitat if that structure had not been there. And we do see this throughout Puget Sound. But there's also indirect habitat loss. So the loss of riparian cover, because these eggs are left, what I say, high and dry on the beach, literally the eggs are on the beach when the tide goes out, they are susceptible to heat stress and desiccation. And so trees actually provide shade to keep the humidity level appropriate and the temperature appropriate for those eggs to survive. And we see lower mortality rates on beaches that have more trees on them. Just a little bit of a background or short geology lesson for Puget Sound. The sediment that feeds our beaches in Puget Sound actually comes from the erosion of the back shore. And so these types of structures actually prevent that sediment from getting to the beach. And this inhibits that sediment that the forage fish or the surf smelt are keying into to spawn on, and actually also impacts the survival rate of those eggs.
Just a quick question on sediment. So along the Chuckanut area, sandstone, are some sediments more, you know, beneficial?
Yeah. So generally for surf smelt, we're looking for what we say is a coarse sand to a pea-sized gravel. And they prefer that mix of sand and gravel because, as you can see, those eggs are very tiny. They're about a millimeter in diameter, and they'll actually settle down into that sediment, and they actually adhere to the sediment as well. So they become anchored in that sediment, and they're sheltered from the desiccation and the heat stress when they're in that sediment. If the sediment's too coarse or too fine, we see higher mortality rates, or they just won't utilize that habitat. Next. So to document this habitat, we've actually been documenting surf smelt habitat since the 1970s using some various methods. But in general, what we're doing is we're surveying a 30-meter stretch of beach, so roughly 100 feet, and we're collecting four samples over that that get homogenized into a single sample that we process. Go ahead. And so the process for collecting these samples is very straightforward. We get scoops of sediment. Next. We then reduce that sediment to just the egg-sized material, so we run it through a set of sieves and retain only material that's between a half millimeter and 2 millimeters in size. Next slide. And then we reduce that sediment by the weight or the density of the sediment. So the eggs are slightly less dense than the sediment that they're in. And so there's been various techniques that we use. This is our latest technique. We call it the vortex method because it's got a V and an X in it, which means it's really cool. But it also means that it's about 50% more efficient than our previous methods, more consistent, more reliable. And so we're much more confident in the results of these surveys using this new method. Next. And then finally, we take those reduced samples back to the lab and actually analyze them for those eggs that you've seen passed around to determine whether there's eggs present on the beach.
Is it present absence?
It's presence absence. We do enumerate eggs for general abundance as well, and we'll also determine the stage of the eggs to determine how many spawning events have occurred within that previous time frame. So on the beach, this is just a cartoon illustrating what that 100-foot or 30-meter survey looks like. And based on information that we collect on the beach, predominantly relying on our assessment of the sediment characteristic, we'll expand that, go ahead, to up to 305 meters, or roughly 1,000 feet. So about 500 feet in either direction is what we'll consider an occupied beach if we determine that there's eggs present. Next slide. So since the 1970s, we've documented just over 300 miles of surf smelt spawning beach using these methods. And this map here illustrates all in the blue dots all the areas that we've documented surf smelt spawning. Next slide. So one of the challenges, and which is really what brings us here today, is that over time we've realized that with the detection efficiency, it's as hard as we try, those eggs are still difficult to identify. And these species, surf smelt in particular, spawn year-round and are sometimes patchy in time and space. So we can visit a beach multiple times, such as the case in the upper left-hand corner where we surveyed a beach 24 times and only on one occasion were we actually there at the right time to find the eggs. And so this has concerned us, and this image illustrates how, because of that spacing issue, there's sometimes areas that haven't been surveyed and areas that we haven't surveyed enough to really document presence, although we suspect the habitat is suitable and that if we had enough effort, we would document presence. So I'm going to pass it off to Tim, and he's going to talk about how we've sort of come around to addressing this issue.
Yeah, that's great. Good afternoon, distinguished people. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today. First of all, I want to expand on the cartoon that Philip had showed you earlier about the what constitutes an occupied beach. Again, when we go out and sample, according to what Phil showed you, and we find an occupied beach, we expand that in either direction, assuming suitable habitat, to about 1,000 feet or 305 meters. There's also an area that's not defined as occupied called this adjacent habitat. And this is important because when we issue permits, we sometimes ask proponents of the permit to if they occur into areas that are adjacent to an occupied beach and the habitat looks very similar, we ask them to do a survey to determine if there are eggs present. This is in recognition of the fact that we haven't sampled fully around Puget Sound and the fact that it is easy to undersample or have false negative reports when you go out and sample. Because you're collecting such a small amount of material, the opportunity for not finding eggs when they're actually there is fairly high. So the study I wanted to talk to you about is this study that was done in Camano Island in 2012. And the study was designed for a variety of purposes. One was to look at this idea of the spacing of eggs in time and space. It was also to try to determine what's the important attributes of a beach that are related to abundance of forage fish eggs. And what the bottom line is that we determined through this modeling exercise and a year-long study survey of visiting these beaches repeatedly through time, we learned that smelt presence at one site was a good predictor, a significant predictor of smelt eggs at another site. So it was our first indication of a spatial distribution or a spatial size at which you could expect to see eggs at one site and then have a better chance of finding eggs at another site. Go ahead. So this is your science for the day, and this is the output of the model that we developed at the department. And really what it demonstrates is that these are every point on that slide is a prediction of our model, and it's shown in relation to the truth. The truth is on the y-axis. So when the model predicts that there we would find eggs at that site, we can ask whether or not we found eggs at that site. And the idea here would be if it was a perfect model, all the points would be shifted to the left on that bottom series of points, and all of those points would be shifted to the right. Now, this is important because when we dealt with our advisory committee, we were very straightforward about the type of information we had, the uncertainty associated with it, because it was a very important part of an advisory committee education process. We wanted them to understand not only the challenges we have as a natural resource agency to find eggs, we wanted them to understand that when we model things, the models are sometimes imperfect. So, and what was so gratifying about working with them and taking the time to talk with them is they got it. So this correlation between the presence of eggs at one site and the presence of eggs at a site 1.2 kilometers away gives us the rationale to say we have now empirical evidence to suggest that the 305 meters is too small relative to the extent of eggs at an occupied beach. So the proposal we made before them, one of the proposals, was that we would expand the occupied beach definition from 305 meters to 1.2 kilometers or 1268 meters. So what we decided we would do for you today, Randy will walk you through the process that she worked with the advisory committee and how we got there and what sort of comments they had. But what we did is we documented or we mocked up our existing forage fish map that shows occupied beaches in red. Those are the occupied beaches based on that 305 meter sample, and then we expanded it to what we're proposing to be the new sample distance, and you can see those are in the yellow stripes.
So thanks for this. You noted that there's habitat that is beneficial to smelt spawning. Is there a seasonality to it as well?
There is, traditionally we had believed that there was a strong seasonality, that they were only there at certain parts of the year. As we've gotten more efficient, as Philip has described, we're tending to find the eggs in places year-round. So we now categorize them as year-round spawners, but we still do have beaches that are designated as seasonally occupied beaches. So we have both types of beaches, seasonally occupied and year-round spawner beaches. Yeah, and we don't show that in this slide. What we're doing is we're showing you occupied beaches, but each one of those beaches would have a designation relative to its spawn timing. And what we showed here basically is that again we added the additional distance. We exclude beaches that we know in this added occupancy length. We exclude beaches that we know don't support forage fish eggs. We don't find forage fish eggs in very fine silty sediments, so those areas are excluded. And we also don't find them on bedrock shores and those types, and large cobble shores. So we're able to use existing data from DNR to direct our model to the appropriate fish-friendly beaches. Importantly, the proposed expansion would roughly double the mapped length of spawning beaches. Here's another picture of go ahead. Is that the last one? Yeah. So I just gave you two pictures of how that would work out. So in summary, the importance of forage fish in the marine food web is becoming better understood. There's a lot more work going on in forage fish in the state in recognition that, as Phil said, there are many species that are dependent on forage fish. WDFW has done a fair amount of new work in the recent past. We've also received much more support for forage fish work coming from the legislature that we could talk about. And then, as suggested in my talk, the new data provides good evidence, really the first empirically, strongly empirical evidence for expanding the occupied area for surf smelt. Okay? All yours.
So Phil and Tim brought the science to me and said, Randy, you're the policy person. Do something with the science. So we recognized that the science supported a change. The first thing we did is we took it to the advisory group. And you may recall when we updated the HPA rules a couple of years ago, we formed this advisory group. And the advisory group is made of 12 members who have very diverse backgrounds, values and opinions, and that's key in this discussion or in this presentation. And what we did is we came to them with some alternatives. First, Tim and Phil spent a meeting briefing them on the science so that they understood what the science said. And then we had a second meeting to talk about what the ramifications would be of the different alternatives. So they looked at keeping the occupied area as is and having this adjacent habitat criteria. Currently in our rules, we have provision in there that if the beach material is suitable for spawning, that the biologist can put a timing window in an adjacent area, an area adjacent to occupied site, but we don't define what that adjacent area is. We would still have that discretion of the biologist to do this. It just wouldn't be defined. The other option was to define what the adjacent area is. So based on the science, to say have the adjacent area extend 482 meters in either direction. And the third option was to have the entire 1,268 meters be considered occupied habitat. And to my surprise, with the diverse opinions and values of the group in the room, they actually unanimously agreed that we should make a change and to increase the occupancy standard and call it all occupied. So I'm still blown away by that. To have that many, have those people all agree on that was really rewarding to me, and I think that they also felt good about it. So what this would mean is that we would change the maps that we have to show this new occupancy standard. But before we did that, and this is an example of our website now and what those maps look like. We did recognize that there's other potential effects on other stakeholders, so we did want to do some additional outreach, which we did. Tim and I gave a webinar where we invited contractors and consultants that work on the marine shoreline. And then we also had, as part of our HPA listening sessions last spring, we did I think we did 20 listening sessions around the state. We had a special one for marine contractors, and again, Tim was kind enough to come and do the presentation for them. So we did want to make sure that we were reaching out to these folks, getting their opinions. We haven't heard a lot of concern from them, partly because they are already required to do these surveys if the beach looks suitable in these adjacent areas. And so I think that's the main reason for it. The other reason is that currently, because most of the Puget Sound, the spawning occurs for 6 months or longer, they haven't the option of doing a survey. And then if the survey shows no spawn, they can go ahead and work. So that's an option where the spawning season is longer. So I don't think they see this as having a lot of effect on them. But when we did meet with them, they certainly had a lot of opinions on what we could do to help them. They recognized that the occupied area would provide some certainty to them, because they would either be in or out. So either the work window would apply or it wouldn't. So and they liked that. They had some concerns about narrowing work windows, but this one changed the work windows themselves. This doesn't do that. So they would like some flexible options. So if they are doing a survey, it shows that there's spawn there. They'd like some flexible options to go ahead and work and then somehow compensate for the potential loss of eggs. And so we did have a meeting with other agencies to talk about that. And there was some openness on the other agencies to look at flexible mitigation options. So potentially paying into a restoration fund or having another vehicle to provide mitigation if there were spawn on the beach. And this would help them out, because right now we require the survey to occur 72 hours before they work. And if there's spawn on the beach, sometimes they've already got the barge loaded and they're ready to go. So this, you know, so this would provide them an opportunity to do their work. So our next step and last step is we've decided to take this through the Environmental Policy Act process. Another public process, just to make sure that folks are truly comfortable with this. This provides a forum for public and other government agencies to comment to us on the proposal. And it ensures that, you know, their comments are given consideration by us, along with any, you know, in terms of the economics and also technical considerations. And then we will respond to all comments and explain, you know, our rationale for this decision. And hopefully, if all goes well, we'll go ahead and change the maps after that time. So that's all I had. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the commission? Very thorough.
Hopefully we got you back on schedule. I think we did.
Good science, too.
Thanks very much.
Thank